Her close-up photos have a way of revealing more than meets the eye. Annie Leibovitz is our guest right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Her latest photo collection contains no faces, but as only Annie can do, it captures the spirit of dozens of great people who are important to our culture. It captures that spirit through the places they lived and the objects that were part of their very lives. She's gathered those photos in a book called Pilgrimage. You did a lot of extremely close-up work, and I think extremely close-up has a great intimacy. I mean, you look at that close-up of Emily Dickinson's only surviving dress, and you can understand the humbleness of the age and the loving stitching that went into that.
I know, it's so not my kind of picture, and I found myself going in. It feels like a big responsibility to go that close.
Yes.
And try to explain yourself.
Well, and to get that ace of hearts with the bullet hole right in the middle from Annie Oakley.
That actually, it is a calling card that she did shoot at targets that were made like an ace of hearts, right?
Right.
But this is actually a calling card. It's
okay.
Very small.
You know, that's what I like about a lot of these shots, which are, I don't think of you in terms of extremely close-up work, and this book has a lot of great extremely close-up work, which gives you an insight.
Well, again, they're notes. It's data. It's they're notes.
The caning on the bed, the frame and the caning of Thoreau's bed.
Oh, that is, I was just so thrown when I saw.
That's his bed in the cabin on Walden Pond.
Exactly. I mean, I thought he slept, you know, on the ground or on nails or something. I mean, that Thoreau had this very sophisticated caned Chinese section from a sofa bed.
I can tell you liked it because it's the one page, I believe, in the book that actually folds out, and that adds a lot of cost to a book, and it's worthwhile.
Yeah, no, I'm not a, that's kind of a book joke to see the fold out like that. So, you know,
We
see fold outs for all kinds of other things.
All right.
So we're folding out Thoreau's bed.
Thoreau's bed. I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Annie Leibovitz about her new book, Pilgrimage. Annie, this is a travel show, and you did a lot of traveling to put this book together. Just from a listener's point of view who's dreaming about traveling and wants to have an insight into some of the great homes or inspirational kind of landscapes we're talking about, what are three or four of the best homes that you'd recommend for people to be sure to put on their list?
Well, Concord is sort of like Concord, Massachusetts is just sort of a hotbed of these writers who, you know, live together at the same time, Emerson and Thoreau and Louise May Alcott, and that's sort of an extraordinary place to go visit, and it's not far from Amherst.
And there's several great places really close together then, so when you go to Concord.
But, you know, I was just talking about this. I mean, it's you don't have to go far. I mean, you know, New York City, it's like every block there's a historic home. I mean, you know, there are small, you know, house museums.
And they're remarkably well-preserved. I mean, there's a lot of 19th century American history that's intimately preserved from the looks of your photographs. Is that accessible to every tourist? I mean, is every photograph in this book is accessible?
Absolutely, it is. I've found that there's a whole new movement in curating now, and the gatekeeping to this material is really being made accessible now. And most of these places, they either have tours or you can set up an appointment to go. You know, the Spiral Jetty is just sitting out there in Salt
that's
Lake.
True, yeah.
You know, it's not a...
Well, as is
Badlands is there. You don't need a ticket for Walden Pond, you know?
Annie, when you looked at all of these great and prolific people's homes, were you struck by how they decorated? I mean, do they put much energy into decoration, and does that give us much of an insight into their passion and their genius?
That's a funny question because I, having visited Monk House, where Virginia Woolf had a writing studio in the back, I was very fortunate. They left me alone in the writing studio to take pictures, and I took everything off of her desk and photographed the top of her desk, and it was like riddled with marks and, you know, cigarette burns, and then I went on to read. Her husband Leonard Woolf writes about how Virginia Woolf was extremely messy. So when you look at this desktop, which I photographed, in fact, it was kind of almost near squalor, apparently, is what I understand. You don't quite take in, when you go visit this house now, which is, you know, run by the National Trust, how they were really living, which was apparently pretty messy. But the desk sort of tells you that. The other thing I learned at Monk House was that, you know, I didn't quite take in having, of course, first run across Emily Dickinson's brother's house, which was kept intact, you know, even though the wallpaper was was falling off and things were, you know, rotting and decaying in the house. At Monk House, the curator there told me that they decided to take the house back to the green period. And I didn't quite understand what that meant, but it was quite beautiful. There, Virginia Woolf painted her living room. It was all painted like this dark green. It was beautiful. I mean, there was some style there. It was definitely some style. The house that probably, I didn't even want to go to this house because it's so seductive and so great. And I sort of feel like I'm not taking the pictures that the house sort of is really this great, which is Virginia Woolf's sister, Vanessa Bell's house. She lived there with Duncan Grant, and it was the height of the Bloomsbury period, and they painted all over the walls. And I have, I believe, 4 pictures inside the house, and I sort of feel it's just sort of the tip of the iceberg there. I mean, it's such a beautiful, extraordinary living presence because they were artists, and they created pottery, and they painted their furniture and their walls and their fireplaces, and it's just kind of amazing that way.
And just to be there, if you have a creative spirit, and to be in the space of somebody who you really admire, that in itself is like a pilgrimage. Actually, that's the name of your book, Pilgrimage.
Exactly, yes. Well, you go to Freud's house in London, and you can't believe, you know, that it's left the way, you know, it was when he was alive, and there is the couch that, you know, he did all his analytical, you know, sessions on. It's still there. It's kind of interesting.
So that's why the name of the book, then. You're going to these places, and it's like a pilgrimage, and it inspires one.
I mean, it's kind of an eclectic mix. I mean, I also went to Graceland. I went to, I had the opportunity to go to Ansel Adams' darkroom, and to see the darkroom still intact. And I did have the opportunity to photograph Ansel in that darkroom in the 70s. So to see the darkroom still there and sort of photograph it as a shrine was...
That'd be a pilgrimage for you.
Yes, it was. There's some photographers in here.
I like to play the piano, and I got to go to the little cabin on the fjord that inspired Edvard Grieg, and I got to see, you know, his piano and his view and his desk and the view that inspired him as he wrote. And, you know, for any sort of person who loves music, that would be a pilgrimage. But the still life of his tools on the desk was just, I'm getting goosebumps just talking about it right now. And the natural light that came in from the windows, and then the fjords that inspired him. And then when you know his art, you close your eyes and you're right there.
No, that's a great description of what can happen.
I would imagine, well, just thumbing through your book, Pilgrimage, the great views of great artists. For instance, Darwin's sandwalk, where he would walk and I would imagine collect his thoughts.
That was very sweet because I had a hard time finding something from Darwin inside the house itself because it had been restored, and also the gift store was in his old office. I mean, at this point, so
the gift store in his office.
Yes, the gift store was in the office, so you know it was a little beyond. But I
that's like you know where Monet painted his water lilies. It's a great studio for an artist. And now it's a huge gift shop.
It is a gift store. That's correct. It's exactly the same thing.
So
there's something that feels a little sacrilegious to me about that. But, you know, these places, they have to make their way.
And a book like yours will encourage people to go there. And it's all part of our heritage. And it's worth helping them make it.
Well, what I hope to encourage, you know, again, this was such a personal project. I'm surprised that anyone else is even... you know, looking at it or whatever, what I would like to encourage is people make their own lists and go off and whatever means something to them. And
talk a bit more about views, because one of my favorites in your book is the view of the garden designed by his wife from inside of Ralph Waldo Emerson.
You know, because apparently he walked up to his bedroom and sat in a chair and died there. I think. I mean, the Emerson house was quite a house. I don't know if you know this or not, but Thoreau actually sort of, you know, helped run the house and was almost like a babysitter there. And it was actually Emerson's woodlot that Thoreau built his cabin on Walden Pond. So for me, it was almost seeing that Emerson, as much as he talked about living outside or living, you know, or being one with nature, he was still behind windows. In other words, he was looking out, not exactly behind bars, but it wasn't a clear landscape like Walden Pond was for Thoreau. I mean, he talked a lot, but he never like really was one with nature, never was outside.
So of all the visits you made, what was a view that really struck you? Like, wow, I never realized this had such an impact on that person's spirit or creativity?
Well, I think that the exercise in Yosemite was an interesting trial, because I was with Jean Adams, Ansel's daughter-in-law, and the first time I went into Yosemite, and we woke up in the morning. I was going to go out and photograph the valley, and there were no clouds in the sky. And Jean Adams said to me, "Well, Annie, Ansel would wait 3 weeks for clouds, you know." And then she went on to say, "And also, Annie, do you know some of those early landscape photographers used to borrow clouds from some pictures and put them in others?" And of course, you know, I was like turning white, because I do this all the time in my in my day job, you know. So then that sort of set me on this path that I wanted to get the valley with clouds in it. I went back actually 10 days before the book was supposed to be turned in. Anyway, it's a lot harder than it looks. It's like I thought it was. I had a great appreciation for Ansel's. When you go to that spot where you look down the valley, and of course, you know, it's still with us because of people like Ansel Adams who gave us these images. But it's a mecca. I was never there by myself. There was always at least one photographer. And then the day I actually got the picture I wanted, there were like maybe 50 or 60 photographers there. It is really a mecca for photographers. It's so beautiful.
And when you get an Ansel Adams sky, I would suppose the photographers come out of the woodwork. I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Annie Leibovitz about her new book, Pilgrimage. Annie, we looked at all of these people's homes and so on, and I'm wondering if Annie Leibovitz was going to go to the home of the woman considered the most celebrated living photographer, your house, what would she find and what would she want to capture in her photo essay? What would they find in your living room?
Well, that's a tough question because, you know, having grown up in a military family where I traveled every couple of years, I actually am a child of the road. I do love to, you know, get out and be on the road, and hence this road trip, so to speak. I grew up driving across this country. Growing up, my family couldn't afford, you know, hotel rooms, and so we slept in the car and we drove, and, you know, my father was stationed in Fairbanks, Alaska, and then we'd drive down to Texas. You know, he'd be stationed in Texas, and then we, you know, Biloxi, Mississippi. So I've traveled pretty extensively through this country, and my children have sort of, you know, forced me to settle down, which is not a bad thing. It's a good thing. You know, I think I built my last home for my children, and I'm trying this idea of staying put, you know, and giving them a consistent, you know, life. But the home I have now is really something for them to live in, and it's a very child-friendly atmosphere.
Do you have your favorite photographs hanging around, or is it a place where you get away from that and you're not Annie the great photographer?
I don't hang my own photographs in my house. I can't afford the art that I really, really love. But when my children started drawing early on, I love their work, because it seems to me that all we try to do as adults is try to get back to being children in our painting. And I started, you know, hanging their work all over the house, and my children's drawings and paintings are so magical and so wonderful. And when they come home from school with the drawings, I'm framing them. So that's what's in the house, is the artwork is my children's. And then I do have a very nice little photography collection of the photographers I've always admired. I have some Lynn Davises in the living room. I have Cartier-Bresson, Robert Frank, an Avedon. So that's what the children are growing up with.
So you're trying to create a nest. You're trying to settle down now.
I am trying.
You sure look like a woman of the road on your photo in the book here, with you in the boots in the back of the pickup there.
Yeah, I am more that person. I mean, these road trips for the children, you know, taking, you know, the children to Niagara Falls, and you know, I do plan this summer to take them out to do, you know, the Midwest. And that's what I've been dying to do is getting them out on the road with me.
How old are they?
They're young. I have the twins are 6, and Sarah is just turned 10.
Maybe they can give the photographer a fresh excuse to look at things.
They will. They did with this book. They will. I'm older now, you know, and to look at these places now and trying to understand, you know, how to settle down. I mean, what's interesting is Annie Oakley, in the book, there's two pages dedicated to a photograph of her trunk.
I love it.
Because,
yeah.
you know, she tried to settle down, but she never did. She lived on the road.
So when you look at Annie Oakley's trunk, you can think of a lifetime on the road yourself.
I do. I like being home more than ever. And as to your question about what does my home look like, it really is something I kind of built for my children, for them to grow up in.
It must be interesting for you now with two twins at 6 years old and another child at 10. Think of the life experience you've had, and now you're kind of looking at what kind of life experience they're going to have.
Well, I can't wait to take them out driving to see this country, because it's a great country. There's a Robert Frost manuscript at the beginning of the book that I discovered at the Jones Library in Amherst, and it's the poem "In Miles to Go Before I Sleep." And Miles to Go Before I Sleep. And it's on the dedication page for my children, you know, to Sarah, Susan, and Samuel, with the idea that we have lots more to do.
And as you thumb through this book, I'm thumbing through it right now, what do you see? If you just thumb through the book and you look at the beautiful images that you've collected in this book, what's the bigger picture here?
Well, I think I didn't quite see it until many of the pictures were hung at a small book signing in New York, and I was looking at them up, and I realized it really was a search, and the search is not over. And you know, don't ask me what I'm searching for, but you know, just to see how people lived and what they did with their lives, and people that I cared about, and just to collect notes. I was just thinking about the Old Faithful picture, which it took me 2 days to get those pictures. Again, I'm thinking about Ansel Adams and what he must have done, what the early pioneer photographers did when they first went out and discovered these places.
Wow, these images tie things together and they keep things alive.
They're everywhere. I mean, you know, these small historical places that give you such resonance and give you a lot of insight into who we are and what to do with ourselves next. You know, I'm a huge fan of photography. I'm just so lucky that I get to do something I really love to do. And this project was something that I needed to do to sort of take care of my work, you know, to feed my heart and my soul and put it back into my portrait work.
Annie Leibovitz, thanks for joining us. Best wishes with your work and finding that nest at home.
Thank you.
Sweet may the fiddle sound, the banjo play, the old hoedown dancers swing round and round when I'm far away. Well, may the world go, the world go, the world go. Well, may the world go when I'm far away. Fresh may the breezes blow, clear may the streams flow, blue above, green below when I'm far away. Well, may the world go, the world go, the world go. Well, may the world go when I'm far away.
Next, we open our phones at 877-333-7425 to check in with you, our listeners. Tell us where you've been or where you'd like to go for a truly meaningful and personal experience. Travel tips and important places, that's just ahead on Travel with Rick Steves.